This is Ori Mir with Americans for Peace Now. I'm speaking with Mark Rosenblum, who you all probably know. He is the founder of APN, and he's also a professor of history and the director of the Center for Jewish Studies at Queens College. Mark just came back from a trip to Israel that he took with the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. What I mainly wanted to ask Mark about is his impressions of the state of efforts toward relaunching the peace process and how the prospects for peace are being perceived now in Israel, particularly by people who are associated with the peace camp.
Well, I think first, outside of the peace camp, before we come to the peace camp, the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations that put together this program, of which APN is a constituent member, and we weighed in with recommendations to some extent. This is 4.5 full days, and I would say that one very striking thing about how the conference went about this is we had 40 presentations by different people, from the prime minister to the foreign minister to the president of the country to the chief of staff to the American ambassador. There were a rich variety of people with a broad band of different political and ideological points of view, not a single Palestinian. Huh. Other than Khalid Abu Tomei, who is a reporter for the Jerusalem Post and the U.S. News and World Report, and is a Palestinian-Israeli citizen with very distinct political orientations. There was not a single Palestinian from the West Bank or even from East Jerusalem that spoke to us. And I don't know that I remember this kind of slim-to-no pickings in terms of a Palestinian voice to perhaps elaborate a different narrative and a different set of opinions, which is one clue as to the sense that the Israeli-Palestinian track is not worthy of serious consideration, even though there was a panel two panels that actually did raise the Palestinian and Israeli question, but without a Palestinian voice present. Very interesting and very important and, I think, alarming.
Mm-hmm.
You had Israeli liberal dovish point of view that was represented in the conference. Ambassador Avi Gill, who's a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy and Planning Institute, a senior advisor to S. Daniel Abrams Center for Middle East Peace,
mm-hmm.
And a long-term advisor and someone that had hitched his wagon to the now president of the country, Shimon Peres. So Avi Gill was there, and he was on a panel with Professor Asher Susser, who is, as some of you might know, at the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle East Studies at Tel Aviv University. The two of them were among the most principled people that insisted on talking about the Israeli-Palestinian dimension. Both remained strong advocates of the two-state solution. And here's where there was an interesting parting, and it's important because I think this is something that is still shocking, as it may seem to some of you that may listen to this. There is a discussion on which road, in terms of the difficult circumstances that exist now. We've just witnessed nearly a half a dozen meetings in Amman that were sponsored by the Quartet with Tony Blair. And the king, more on him in a second, King Abdullah of Jordan, was the host and actually prevailed upon Prime Minister Netanyahu to come to this and to listen, and also persuaded the Palestinians. So Saba Arafat and Mocha, the Israeli negotiator, did show, and yet they have very little to show for it up until now. So there was a sense of, wow, we went through the last period with no breakthrough, and you have Hamas and Fatah trying to reunify, and this seemed to be more or less a blame game with neither side going to make the compromises necessary. But the Iran question was the overhang, big issue everywhere. And on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, Avi Gill and Susser broke through in their panel, which was on assessing regional dimensions. So it's interesting, it wasn't tied to the Israel-Palestinian question directly, but that's what Avi Gill and Asher Susser focused on. And they basically said the democratic Jewish character of the state depends on a two-state solution. Avigil still believes in the prospect of a permanent status agreement based on 67 land with swaps, which is another way of saying not the 67 border, that there will be swaps between Israelis and Palestinians with strong engagement by third parties, including the United States. And Avigil anticipated a volatile Israeli political electorate that could surprise all of us in 6 months, 8 months, a year, and there could be a new government, even one led by Netanyahu in the future, that has a different constituency, not so hard line, that could negotiate and should be encouraged to negotiate based on the volatile, almost radioactive permanent status issues, all of them, Jerusalem, refugees, not just borders and security, which is the one they're talking about now, and the border and security has very clear implications for security, but he was talking about all of the permanent status issues. He had a very interesting take on it, and Susser, this professor from Moshe Dayan University, also said he totally endorsed the idea of the urgency and the need to salvage the two-state solution, but is very chagrined about prospects anytime soon. That is, he thinks Netanyahu would finish his tour of duty, which, by the way, he'll be the first prime minister to serve the full term since Menachem Begin from 1977 to 1981.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, so it's quite stark.
Yeah.
And Susser says he's going to finish and be the first one and probably has a good chance of being reelected, but he believes that the peace camp in Israel and the center in Israel has to insist, even if there isn't a partner, because of the mess of a divided Palestinian polity between Fatah and Hamas, Gaza and the West Bank, and even if they can't get their act together, and there's no one with whom to negotiate, which he thinks, you know, there probably is, but if this is the winning argument, the liberal and left peace camp has to insist on, if necessary, a unilateral withdrawal, doing it not because America's pressuring, not because the Palestinians demand it, but because it's in Israel's ultimate existential security interest to preserve the possibility of a future two-state solution. And if we let this two-state solution not be protected during this period, and he was willing to support another round of unilaterals in spite of moans and groans in the entire hall where people were thinking, Gaza, 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 you idiot. Look what happened there in the unilaterals. And he defended it. So there was a vigorous discussion between Avigil and Asher Susser, and there was another round of discussion about a two-state solution with Shlomo Avineri, Dori Gold, and Ruth Lapidot, who some of you might know is a very distinguished professor of law and a senior researcher, I believe, at the Jerusalem Institute for Israel Studies, if I'm not remembering this incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And they had also a very intense discussion. And Avineri was afraid that the two-state solution might be lost in this period and ended up saying, no matter what happens, there has to be a comprehensive settlement freeze for Israeli security reasons, for ethical reasons, and for political reasons. But he did not defend the prospect of a two-state solution and any short-term prospect for it emerging. And Ruth Lapp, and Danny Rothschild, by the way, moderated that, and he is from, formerly was the head of the Council for Israeli Peace and Security, currently the director for the Institute for Policy and Strategy at Herzliya, the Interdisciplinary Center. He also was an advocate for the two-state solution, very forthrightly here. So there are a lot of voices that are not nailing the coffin shut. Everyone agrees there's some life support system. And there was some interesting discussion about the need to protect and honor what the Palestinians have preserved. King Abdullah was a fascinating study here, very fluid, extremely well-informed. We met with the foreign minister at the foreign ministry before we met with the king. The king didn't need anyone at his side. He talked intelligence. He talked politics. He talked... And he's the one, I think, that made an interesting observation. In Arabic and in Hebrew, there's a word that is missing, strategic. Mm-hmm. He laments the fact there is no strategic thinking taking place and yet he hosted these five or six different recent talks about the possibility of reengaging diplomacy and negotiations officially, and was distressed and thought there was a 10% chance maybe that this would move to something, and lamented the fact that no one is thinking strategically. The presidency knowledge of the United States is caught in a 24/7 focus on his reelection campaign. The Palestinians are divided. And he talked about what was happening just across the border with Syria, and talked about this killing machine of the Syrian and Assad regime. And while talking about it in negative terms, feared that they would fall.
Mm-hmm.
He believed who was ready to pick up the pieces was the Muslim Brotherhood. He mentioned also Al-Qaeda is insinuating its way in the domestic succession struggle in Syria. And he obviously was talking about his own internal situation and the fear that a fall of the Assad regime and its replacement with the Muslim Brotherhood would metastasize into his own kingdom. He talked with great calmness, with great fluidity, but you could see there was urgency in his voice. And he surprisingly said that Netanyahu did say something that was significant and did talk about a territorial compromise. He hoped to get a real map and a more exacting representation from Prime Minister Netanyahu in the week or weeks coming up. And he also, I think, alluded to the compromise that Netanyahu made in terms of the Jordan Rift Valley, in no longer sticking by the a priori demand that there be Israeli sovereignty over the Jordan Rift Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not inconsequential. Going fast forward to the meeting with Prime Minister,
Maybe, Mark, just explain really quickly, if not sovereignty, then what?
Presence, and right. He wouldn't mention the amount of time that the Israelis would be present to provide some reassurance on Israel's eastern front.
Right, right.
But it was a suspension of the demand for sovereignty, which I think the king suggested, alluded to as not inconsequential.
Mm-hmm.
And then the prime minister himself did allude to the fact of how open he was, and he did put things on the table, and he stuck to one thing and drove it home and said the one thing that is the litmus test for the Palestinians now is their recognizing the Jewish state of Israel. And so the Jewish recognition of Israel is the one he's not willing to relent. The skeptics in Israel believe this is precisely because they know how difficult, if not impossible, it is, seemingly, for Palestinian national leadership to accept this because of what it would mean to the kith and kin of Palestinian relatives in Israel that presumably would view the recognition of the Jewish state of Israel as basically saying, what are we as Christians and Muslims, chopped liver? So the prime minister really stuck almost to this as a Johnny one note of the one precondition that he had as the ultimate test for the Palestinians. I think that we had interesting briefings from the security and intelligence community. They were almost all straightforward and talked about almost to a person the need to protect what was the success here. King Abdullah, in a very, very revealing and fascinating comment, singled out as the one bright star in the Palestinian front, Salam Fayyad, for his transparency in economics, for his success in developing a new security presence with the IDF, which the Israelis should not want to lose. And all the Israeli security people that we pushed in conversations all acknowledge this, in fact, was a major benefit. And the institution building in the West Bank needs to be protected and shouldn't be allowed to be a casualty. Our meetings at the foreign ministry, including with the foreign minister, raised this also as a concern. But it should be mentioned, to be honest here and to be transparent, the foreign minister himself, Lieberman, set down a very bizarre of a timeline and litmus test of negotiating with the Palestinians. Obviously, he said, the moment Abu Mazen and Fayyad get in bed and really start to now agree to and implement an agreement with Hamas in Gaza, there's not a partner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But more interestingly, and very bizarre, was he laid out a timeline of when we would have somebody, the Israelis would have someone to talk to. And it's when their gross domestic product was half of what the Israeli gross domestic product was. In other words, he turned the Israeli-Palestinian conflict into an economistic test of growing their economy. And when they were half, and he gave us the statistic, and I don't know if it's accurate, but right now the Palestinians, the Israeli gross domestic product is something in the order of $30,000 per capita, and the Palestinian is like one-twelfth of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to get up from the 4% or 5% to 15%, half of the Israeli gross domestic product. It was quite astounding.
Yeah, that is quite bizarre. Right.
So there was some bizarre things. So the good and the bad, the ugly of our mission, I think, is bottom line. While the right may think the center is broken, the center and the left is broken, and the idea of a two-state solution is dead and buried, I think that this is not entirely what we heard at the conference. There were five or six defenders of the two-state solution, but none of them were thinking there was an immediate great leap to permanent status negotiations today, even though Avi Gill suggested this is something that needs to be pushed and in the next election. And I think that the bad in all this was we heard some really stark and very sad comments that were made that were very ethnocentric by one or two members of the Conference of Presidents. One person who was there in the conference delegation suggested maybe tactical nuclear weapons can be used to help Israel cope with its problems. And, of course, the Iranian
issue. You mean used by Israel against Iran?
Yeah, against Iran, yes. There was also a very distasteful comment that was made at a meeting I wasn't at, but I got briefed and got some specific language where they were talking with people when they were visiting NATO people and European Union people, and some of these EU people were talking about their efforts to work with pragmatic and moderate Muslims in Europe, and was talking rather enthusiastically about it. And one of the members of the conference that will remain unnamed intervened and said, well, why don't you just expel them from your country? And the European Union commentator sort of didn't understand what just happened, and it was repeated. So there clearly are some extreme hardline and very nasty things that are thought by people that are involved in some of this work. But I would say that we still have, you know, hope without delusion that holds in terms of the liberal Zionist peace camp. But and there are actually are some people that still believe that Netanyahu and a new government may yet do the deed, even though I think this is few people. So I'd say it's fair to say that an optimist is not by definition an ill-informed pessimist, but optimism is really without delusion, and people understand that at this stage there is a real risk of a war. And I might say one of my own views that I came back with and hearing Israeli panels that were very interesting. They were not a series of hardline, hawkish people that we met with. There were some remarkably moderate voices that we heard in terms of Iran and keeping your powder dry, so to speak, and not going the war option. But there was this sense that, for me, there is perhaps, I'm not sure if it's Keystone Cops and just incredible incompetence in managing this issue of Iran and the question of it getting nuclear weapons, or whether it really feels like we're in a precursor to a revisit of the Cuban Missile Crisis without a Khrushchev to back down. It was very nerve-wracking to hear some of the scenarios people were cavalierly talking about, even though, again, our panels were by and large very, very alarmed and clear about the consequences and the downside and the blowback Israel would confront. But there is this sense of both sides now, and it happened when we were there, both sides are letting it be known they're thinking about preempting.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I know you have to go, so I'll ask you one last question really quickly, and that is, President Obama will receive Prime Minister Netanyahu in the White House on Monday. This is March 5th. And if you could just say a few words on what we should expect from that meeting.
Well, I think it's going to be because everyone else except the president has been visiting Jerusalem and Tel Aviv to find out from Barack, the prime minister, anybody else, what it is that they intend and whether the Israelis really do believe a zone of immunity and a strategic threshold is being crossed and this threat to preempt. And I think there'll be a lot of behind-the-scenes, very close discussions between these two men of serious, again, there is a word called strategic in English.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping, I don't know that I expect entirely it to go beyond Iran. I think this is very much about trying to get a handle on how close we are to a march of folly.
Yeah.
And preventing it.
Mark Rosenblum, thank you very much.
Thank you, Uri. All the best.
Okay.